This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The Florida legislature's recently convened annual session isn't getting as much attention as it usually does due to the rapidly evolving situation with the COVID-19 outbreak. But lawmakers took the scheduled 60-day session into overtime and last Thursday passed a $93.2 billion budget for the fiscal year beginning July 1st. The budget does include some last-minute changes caused by the spread of the novel coronavirus, including the allocation of $52.5 million for the state's COVID-19 response, although most of that is federal money. Lawmakers also made another $300 million in contingency funds available to Governor Ron DeSantis to be used in the emergency response, on top of a $3 billion relief fund intended for emergencies. However, the pandemic could wind up costing the state billions of dollars in sales tax revenue, which will likely force lawmakers to reconvene for a special session this summer to rework the budget. Meanwhile, the state economists, whose estimates are used to frame the state budget, are now meeting every month instead of just quarterly in order to make more up-to-date projections as the situation continues to change rapidly. Joining me now for a closer look at the legislative session, which bills passed, which bills didn't, and how lawmakers are responding to the COVID virus are Florida Gulf Coast University political scientist Dr. Peter Bergerson and Dr. Roger Green. Peter, Roger, and I are in the spirit of practicing social distancing, connecting via phone today, but it's still great to reconnect with you, even if we can't do it in person. Peter and Roger, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Great to have you.
Well, thank you very much. John. Yeah. Good to see you, John and Roger.
Right. To engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Or call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, we'll get into the nuance of some non-COVID-19 statutory changes stemming from the legislative session a bit later in the conversation. But first, do you think it's all but certain that lawmakers are going to be reconvening for a special session before July 1st when the state's new fiscal year is set to begin? And Peter, I'll start with you.
I do. Even though in your introduction suggested that the legislature and the governor came to some agreement on a $25 million towards the virus. That is hardly going to touch the extent of the cost that it's going to be to the taxpayers here in Florida. That's just a drop in the bucket, and I think almost everybody in the legislature and those watching the political developments here in Florida see the economic repercussions of the virus.
Peter, anything to add? Or, I mean, pretty much certain we're going to be back in session soon?
Roger.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I agree with Peter completely. I think it's a foregone conclusion that the legislature will have to reconvene to deal with the repercussions of the COVID-19 outbreak. In addition to the fact that the money that has been allocated for the response is going to fall woefully short of what will ultimately be needed, based on the projections that I think are coming from public health specialists, I think the probable revenue shortfalls that we can expect due to the economic calamities that this is going to precipitate are going to require a lot of scrambling as well. I mean, the revenue shortfalls, I think they were probably expecting, if I remember correctly, about $3 billion in tax revenue to come out of the tourist industry this coming year, and I think tourism is going to be devastated this year, needless to say, but a variety of other economic sectors, I think across the board, are going to take a terrible hit, and I think this is going to be the really big story moving forward this year politically in Florida, as well as in the other states.
Yeah, DeSantis had wanted this year's session to be the, you know, year of the teacher. He was calling on raising minimum wage of first-year teachers in Florida to $47,500 a year. That would have cost about $600 million. Lawmakers approved about $100 million less than what the governor was asking for. So assuming that that money winds up staying in the budget, it's still not necessarily going to be enough for teacher raises across the board. Not all districts are going to be able to reach that $47,500 threshold. But, you know, assuming that money stays in, is that something that the governor can tout as a success?
I think at the start he can, for sure. And, you know, it's a good start, and he should, I think, be recognized for it. But whether it actually reaches payday is going to be a totally different story. I just can't conceive of how that size of an increase it can be matched under the revenue projections that are for sure are going to come, just not only from the tourist industry, but from the hotel and hospitality, just really across the board, as Roger suggested. And so there's going to be cuts there for sure, because the education budget is one of the largest in the one of the largest segments in the state budget.
Right.
Oh. Yeah, and I think Governor DeSantis, I mean, politically, Governor DeSantis can still proclaim the passage of that legislation and the still substantial, somewhat reduced, but still substantial funding for the starting teacher pay increase. That can be proclaimed as a political victory, even if moving forward there's a fairly significant likelihood that that may not be implemented the way it was intended to. I mean, I just think pretty much any big budget items that were enacted this year by the legislature are going to be revisited and moving forward potentially scaled back on. But politically, it's still a success for DeSantis.
Sure. Well, another one of those, big budget items that now is likely up in the air includes the $370 million the legislature set aside for affordable housing programs. The reason I bring this up is because, as we know, in past years, state lawmakers have made quite the habit of raiding the Sadowski Trust. That's money that's supposed to be set aside for affordable housing programs. This year was a bit of a change. But do you think that maybe going forward, even if that money doesn't stay in the budget in the face of potential shortfalls in the billions of dollars, that in future years, this might signal a change in the mindset of lawmakers when it comes to the importance of funding affordable housing programs?
I'm hoping it does, John. I think the fact that this was finally recognized as a flawed approach in prior years is a victory of sorts. I would not be surprised if in this coming year, the outcome there in the budget sense is going to be reversed. But I think it has signaled something that's going to maybe make it more difficult in future years for anyone to contemplate kind of going back to the way they were essentially raiding that fund in prior years.
Right. One of the initial steps that surprised me that lawmakers have already taken in preparation for this projected revenue shortfall is scaling back their tax break package plans. And it didn't surprise me because it's not a prudent move. It certainly was, but simply because tax breaks packages are so popular.
Yes.
Yeah, I was surprised too, particularly in a couple of areas, in order to meet the increases, particularly in education, why they have cut back on some of the tax breaks that were given. I saw that as a positive move as well on behalf of the governor, as well as going back to the affordable housing. I think as long as the DeSantis stays as governor, this is going to be a priority item for him. I think this is really a social commitment that he's made.
Yes, right. I agree.
Well, let's maybe try and talk about some big pieces of legislation that were passed this year that maybe aren't going to be potentially impacted by COVID-19. One of those that definitely counts as a major victory for conservative Republicans was passage of the abortion restriction measure. Now, that bill passed will require parental consent before an abortion can be performed on someone under 18 years old. Any surprise that that bill passed this year, given its failure? A nearly identical bill failed in 2019.
For me, it was. Yeah, I was surprised. It appears to me that the governor made some kind of a deal to accept this, in knowing that it may go to the courts, and they would eventually resolve that particular issue in return for votes for other aspects of his legislation that he favored.
Go ahead, Roger.
I was going to express agreement with Peter. My interpretation of it was that this reflected some kind of deal making on the part of the governor in order to, have greater prospects of advancing his agenda. I don't think this is something that would have made it through this way otherwise.
It passed so quickly, though, that it got me thinking about that nearly identical bill in 2019 that failed to pass, and how at that time we were seeing similar proposals aimed at restricting abortion access being considered all across the country. And it seemed like maybe people were just paying more attention to the issue more broadly at that time. Do you think that helped lawmakers get it passed this year? Less vocal opposition, perhaps?
Yeah, I do. I think that early on in the negotiation process, the pro-abortion lobby said, look, we want this as a very high priority issue. If you want our votes in return for other agenda items, then we want this placed on the top and not wait to the end where the pressure of time in essence, the issue gets pushed off the table because of the end of the 60-day mandatory session.
Right. Well, another priority of Governor DeSantis that was successful this year was a measure requiring employers in Florida to use the federal E-Verify database to check that workers are actually eligible to work in the U.S. Public employers will now have to use E-Verify, while private employers will have the option of using another employment eligibility system already required under federal law. The measure passed, but not without some contention. What's been the controversy for years now with requiring employers in Florida to use E-Verify?
The basic issue has been that it's strongly opposed by, agriculture, tourism, and construction industries. And the three of them collectively represent a pretty potent lobbying force, and they don't want to deal with the additional constraints that E-Verify would pose, even though E-Verify in states that have adopted it in a more widespread way has been a pretty successful platform to use. But the watered down version that was passed here, where it's public employers and businesses that essentially are doing business or get contracts with public employers, I would say that has to be regarded as a success on the part of the opposition that was mounted by the agriculture, tourism, and construction industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no question about it. And there also is a penalty burden on the employer, and that's what also they don't want. In other words,
yes.
They not only do they not want to have the responsibility of verifying their employees as eligible to be employed, they don't want the risk that comes with the fact that the financial or criminal penalty that could possibly be assessed.
Mm-hmm. Well, switching gears a little, and again, this is going to address some allocation of money, so this could all change in a couple months, but lawmakers did send a measure to the governor's desk that seeks to reduce nutrient pollution that can feed toxic blue-green algae blooms in Florida waterways. And again, a lot of money here when you're talking about septic tank rebuilds, you know, making changes to stormwater infrastructure, addressing fertilizer runoff from farms. Again, this is something that folks like. This is still something that's been very popular politically, with especially folks around Southwest Florida who remember what the summer of 2018 was like when we were dealing with those dual red tide and blue-green toxic algae blooms. Just because of the importance of this issue environmentally, do you think it's likely that that money is going to stay in there? Or, again, could this be on the chopping block like anything else that's going to involve a large infusion of taxpayer funds?
My thought is going to be that, because given the size of it, that the legislature is going to reduce the amounts that are given. I think that the environmental issues are clearly significant and important. I don't see that the entire appropriations for Forever Florida or for the Everglades and other water projects are going to be totally wiped out. But again, there's a clear cloud over the budget in relationship to the revenue sources, and they're going to have to look at all aspects, including the resources devoted to the blue-green algae, the Everglades, and Forever Florida.
I agree with Peter. I would foresee reductions. I mean, it was heartening to see these make it through the legislature the way that they did. I applaud that, but I think moving forward, again, given the budget calamities we're likely to face, you know, from the COVID-19 problem, I would foresee reductions.
All right. If you're just joining the show, we're speaking with FGCU political scientists Roger Green and Peter Bergerson about this year's annual state legislative session and how the state budget could be impacted by the COVID-19 outbreak going forward. If you would like to join our conversation with your comments or questions, call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. Now, Florida lawmakers also passed a measure that makes it more difficult for citizens to change the state constitution through a petition drive. In the past, citizen initiatives needed signatures from at least 10% of voters and at least 1/8 of the state's congressional districts in order to trigger a Supreme Court review of the proposed ballot language. But going forward, this is going to get more difficult. That threshold of signatures is going to be 25% of voters and at least half of the state's congressional districts. What's the impetus for lawmakers to make that change and make it so much more difficult for a citizen-led initiative to actually make it on the ballot?
The legislature does not like citizen initiatives. I mean, the reason why the citizen initiative process has become, you know, increasingly popular and prevalent in Florida politics is because of the many years in which, you know, legislative factions that can define the agenda have essentially kept, you know, kind of, you know, pushed away initiatives or preferences that might have had some fairly substantial backing among the population. So, you know, as an alternative to legislative inaction, the citizen initiative process has become more prevalent, and legislators do not like that. So, this was no surprise to me that they would have been seeking to and been successful in making it more difficult for citizen initiatives to, you know, to kind of move forward. And that's a pretty substantial heightening of the burden or the hurdle that has to be cleared for the process to move forward. 10-25% that's a substantial increase in the number of signatures required. And the number of congressional districts that are needed as well, that's a much higher hurdle that has to be cleared now.
Go ahead, Peter.
I was going to say I agree with Roger And also, this has been something that the legislature has addressed, even as we have seen with constitutional amendments that they haven't liked.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, the amendment that dictated or at least set the class size of the student class size for elementary and secondary education, even last year when they tried to overturn the vote for the amendment that allowed convicted felons to, who had served their time or whatever to allow them to vote. So this has been an issue that the legislature has been trying to curtail for a number of years here in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. One of the more bizarre stories from this year's annual session involves, a subpoena seeking information that could result in criminal prosecution of former Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence CEO Tiffany Carr, after it was revealed that she received up to $7.5 million in pay over 3 years. The coalition has since been stripped of its exclusive power to allocate domestic violence response dollars. Tiffany Carr now lives out of state. Local law enforcement efforts to reach her were unsuccessful. I think at one point the House even tried to issue a subpoena to her via Twitter. Just bizarre. Was any of that successful?
Well, not really. Only symbolically, as far as I can see, there was a lot of what you might say is face time given to the issue and the absconding of the millions of dollars. But other than that, there's nothing that leads to a serious attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, one measure that failed this year was a proposal to give the state and not local municipalities control over regulation of short-term rentals. That was loudly opposed by some local governments, including Cape Coral in particular. That measure died. Governor DeSantis, though, had voiced his opposition to it, as well as the local municipalities. Do you think this gives us any insight into the governor's views generally when it comes to the concept of home rule?
Oh, go ahead.
I'll be honest with you. I think that would be a far stretch to his idea of home rule in relationship to this.
Okay.
I think that it just died because of there was not enough interest. It came about at the end of the session. The coronavirus all of a sudden changed the entire mood at the legislature, and this is an issue that just didn't have enough force behind it.
All right. And the House this year approved a measure that would end the State Constitution Revision Commission. The Senate did not vote on it. And this is something that we saw momentum building about after the Constitution Revision Commission convened last and put this whole slew of confusing amendment proposals on the ballot in 2018. They included, issues that didn't even relate to one another. Do you think this is something that we'll see come back up in 2021? Or since the CRC only meets every 20 years, is that just going to kind of simmer out?
My guess is... Well, go ahead, Roger.
I was going to say, I actually would predict that it's going to peter out for a while, at least for some time. I think that even issues where there would still be some interest on the part of some legislators, I think those are at least for a while now going to get displaced by the gravity of the public health situation that the state is experiencing and the budget impact that's going to have. I just don't see this one being sort of a front burner issue for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Roger.
I would be curious about your personal insights on the CRC, if you'd be willing to share them. Is this something that still has merit, or do you think it's something that needs to go? Or could it be revamped, like if they actually put people on the commission who were qualified constitutional law experts and not just the political friends of whoever's in power at the Tallahassee at the time?
You know, I think it would be a good idea, but my personal would be to keep it, but to refine it and to address some of the serious problems with it. And I guess, as you suggested, to have individuals who are seriously interested in constitutional revision rather than some political agenda that they may have at that particular time. It was frankly an embarrassing and disgrace, the Constitutional Convention the Commission, and I hope they keep it just for the sake that it does empower the people if they wish, and if it's used wisely to make some meaningful changes.
Right. And, you know, the Senate scuttled a House proposal this year to move the State Office of Energy from the Department of Agriculture to the Department of Environmental Protection, and thus it would be under the purview of the governor and not the Agriculture Commissioner, Nikki Fried. Fried vocally opposed this measure. She characterizes it as a political attack, given that she's the only Democrat currently holding statewide elected office. What are your thoughts? Is this something that you think would have come up if, say, Republican Matt Caldwell had won the Ag Commissioner race instead of Nikki Fried?
No, I don't think it would have come up.
Okay, so you're thinking this is completely politically motivated.
You could make an argument that perhaps there's some logic to energy being kind of incorporated
with the EP,
with the EP. But I just think in this particular circumstance, given Nikki Fried being the sole Democrat, I think it was a political stunt.
No question about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in 2018 and again in 2019, we saw the state legislature pass some pretty broad school safety measures. And of course, the legislature was meeting at the time that the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School public mass shooting was taking place. So, you know, we certainly understand where the impetus came there. This year, that didn't happen. There was a bill on the table that included recommendations from the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission and a state wide grand jury, and it just didn't go anywhere. What are your thoughts on that? Is this more of what we've seen in the past, even on a national level, where immediately following a mass shooting, there's momentum on school safety issues, but then as time goes by, that momentum and the pressure to do something wanes, at least until the next mass shooting?
Yeah, I mean, in political scientists, I mean, there's a concept that political scientists oftentimes refer to, which is the issue attention cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the idea that policy issues or initiatives have a certain they exhibit a kind of life cycle, and they have a certain kind of time frame that they operate in accordance with. And I think this reflects the issue attention cycle. There simply wasn't the gravity and immediacy associated with the aftermath of a tragedy like that would have helped advance it through a legislature that was focused on a lot of other issues this session.
Sure.
Yeah, I would agree, and you know, there just was not enough of a groundswell to address these issues under the present environment. It just wasn't there, other than not that the issues weren't serious enough, it's just there wasn't enough political horsepower to carry it through the legislature.
Right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guests, Florida Gulf Coast University political scientists Dr. Roger Green and Dr. Peter Bergerson. As always, great to speak with you and to hear your insights.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Nice to be here again.
If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.